Let's turn together now to Psalm 122a. Psalm 122a. Remember when the Jews went up to Jehovah's house, they were thinking that primarily as being Jerusalem. Now, with the coming of Christ and the movement of the church throughout the whole world, that's us here. But we're singing about Jerusalem here. I'm going to be preaching this morning about the three Jerusalems. So allow that to be in your thoughts as we rise to sing together. 122a, we'll sing the three stanzas.
Oh, home. I'm going when to Jehovah's house, show our faces to me. Jerusalem, within thy gates, our feet shall stand in thee. Jerusalem, a city is compactly built and strong, where to the tribes go up, the tribes that to the Lord belong. An ordinance for Israel, to thank the Lord alone. For thrones of judgment there are set in David's royal throne. Oh, pray ye that Jerusalem may have abundant peace, for everyone that loveth thee shall prosper and increase. I therefore wish that peace may still within thy walls remain, and ever may thy palaces prosperity retain. For brothers and companions' sake, let me now wish thee peace. And for the house of God the Lord, my care shall never cease.
Be seated. I wish sometimes you could see some of those who were involved in the building of this house. Eddie's here today. Compactly built and strong. If anything ever happens to these roof rafters or the wiring or anything else, these men sort of understand how to sing this psalm and also how to pray for the continuing peace and prosperity and strength of this house. Now, having said that, let's turn to we'll read the Bible backwards again this morning. Revelation 21, meaning we're reading from the epistles to begin with. Revelation 21, verses 2 and 3. Subject's going to be the three Jerusalems. Revelation 21, beginning in verse 2. If you'd like a Bible, please hold up your hands and the ushers will see that you have one. Good. Everybody has your own this morning. Revelation 21, verses 2 and 3. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he will dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes, and there shall be no more death, neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things are passed away. Now back for the reading from the Gospels in John 16. John chapter 16, please. Gospel according to John. Chapter 16, And we'll begin in verse 7. Jesus is speaking. Nevertheless, I tell you the truth. It is expedient for you that I go away. For if I go not away, the Comforter will not come unto you. But if I depart, I will send him unto you. And when he is come, he will reprove the world of sin and of righteousness and of judgment. Of sin, because they believe not on me. Of righteousness, because I go to my Father and you see me no more. Of judgment, because the prince of this world is judged. I've yet many things to say unto you, but ye cannot bear them now. Now turn back with me, please, to Isaiah, the second chapter, Isaiah chapter 2. As we continue this study of the book of Isaiah, we will go on into 3 and 4 to look at a few verses, but it's Isaiah 2 we're primarily interested in. The word that Isaiah, the son of Amoz, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, Come ye, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against. Full of horses, neither is there any end of their chariots. Their land also is full of idols. They worship the work of their own hands, that which their own fingers have made. And that the mean man boweth down, and the great man humbleth himself. Therefore forgive them not. Enter into the rock, and hide thee in the dust, for fear of the Lord, and for the glory of his majesty. The lofty looks of man shall be humbled, and the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. For the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon every one that is proud and lofty, and upon every one that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low. And upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and upon all the oaks of Bashan, and upon all the high mountains, and upon all the hills that are lifted up, and upon every high tower, and upon every fenced wall, and upon all the ships of Tarshish, and upon all pleasant pictures. And the loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be made low, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. And the idols he shall utterly abolish, and they shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth for fear of the Lord, and for the glory of his majesty, when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. In that day a man shall cast his idols of silver and his idols of gold, which they made each one for himself to worship, to the moles and to the bats, to go into the clefts of the rocks and into the tops of the ragged rocks, for fear of the Lord and for the glory of his majesty, when he ariseth to shake terribly the earth. Cease ye from man, whose breath is in his nostrils, for wherein is he to be accounted of? Then going on for a moment. For behold, the Lord of hosts, doth take away from Jerusalem and from Judah the stay and the staff, the whole stay of bread and the whole stay of water, the mighty man and the man of war, the judge and the prophet, the prudent and the ancient, the captain of 50, the honorable man, the counselor, the cunning artificer, the eloquent orator. And I will give children to be their princes, and babes shall rule over them. And the people shall be oppressed, every one by another, and every one by his neighbor. The child shall behave himself proudly against the ancient, and the base against the honorable. Verse 8. For Jerusalem is ruined, and Judah is fallen, because their tongue and their doings are against the Lord, to provoke the eyes of his glory. Verse 12. As for my people, children are their oppressors, women rule over them. O my people, they which lead thee cause thee to err, and destroy the way of thy paths. Verse 16. Moreover, the Lord saith, because the daughters of Zion are haughty, and walk with stretched out necks, and wanton eyes, walking and mincing as they go, and making a tinkling with their feet. Therefore the Lord will smite with a scab the crown of the head of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will discover their secret parts. In that day the Lord will take away the bravery of their tinkling ornaments about their feet, and their cauls, and their round tires like the moon, the chains, and the bracelets, and the mufflers. And down verse 24, it shall come to pass that instead of sweet smell, there shall be stink. Instead of a girdle, a rent. Instead of well-set hair, baldness. Instead of a stomacher, a girding of sackcloth, and burning instead of beauty. In chapter 4 and verse 1, and in that day seven women shall take hold of one man, saying, we will eat our own bread, wear our own apparel, only let us be called by thy name to take away our reproach. The verse that may summarize all this and more yet is verse 1. The vision, the word that Isaiah saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. And children, watch and see if you can find the three Jerusalems that Isaiah is describing here for us today. And then draw pictures that will show the differences among these three Jerusalems. Now, I don't know how you're going to do that, but you always seem to find a way of doing it. And there'll be three different Jerusalems here. And for you to find out what those are and then draw pictures showing the differences among those three Jerusalems. And then bring those tonight and we'll show them to the congregation. And you may also be able to show them in your elders groups tonight. Before we begin with the description of that first Jerusalem, I want again to pause for a moment to see something of the historical and political background of Israel in this book of Isaiah. One of the reasons why we're studying here right now is because this is such a politically sensitive time, not only for the United States, but for the world. And there are many people who are saying there are going to be great changes, and we know there'll be an election coming up, but there are other things that are taking place on the international horizon. And the book of Isaiah was not written just for Jews. The vision of this man Isaiah and his understanding of the political confederations that were taking place throughout the whole world is an amazing thing. And so we need to pause for a moment to catch something of this political and historical background. Israel had been prosperous and strong for more than 50 years through three different, we'd call them administrations, but actually these were three different kings, grandfather and father and son administrations. First was that good king Uzziah, who had fortified all the boundaries of Israel. He'd extended his authority and his controls. He had greatly increased and developed her resources, while the whole nation of Judah wasn't much larger than three or four of our Indiana counties. Uzziah had won a port, an outlet at sea on the Red Sea. He had built a navy. He had restored the commerce with the Far East that I think Solomon had begun. He was the grandfather. Uzziah had conquered the neighboring nations, the Philistines, the desert Arabs. They all paid Uzziah tribute. And with the extra income, Uzziah had increased the fortifications of Jerusalem. There were new towers all around Jerusalem now. He had developed agricultural programs. He imported new plants. He developed an irrigation system that was common throughout the nation. He built up a powerful army, and he developed a whole new concept in artillery. God said it. His name spread far abroad, for he was marvelously helped till he was strong. And it's interesting to me that Isaiah never says anything much about what was the downfall of Uzziah. But he had become proud. And one day he went into the temple and insisted on burning incense, the thing that was reserved for the priest to do. And he was struck with leprosy. And from there on, he never recovered. It was terminal. His leprosy became worse and worse. Uzziah's son, Jotham, when he was very young, as a teenager, took over the kingdom. And he continued his father's successes. He quelled the rebellions. He brought in even more riches and money. He gave Jerusalem and Judah even greater name among the nations. But Jotham then, in his turn, somehow or other, forgot to teach his son Ahaz about God and about God's laws for the individual, for the family, for the church, and for the state. He forgot to teach Jotham. He forgot to teach Ahaz. So when Ahaz came to the throne, he was very young, he was very spoiled, and he was very effeminate. His father, Jotham, and his grandfather, Uzziah, had been rugged men, but Ahaz was a weakling. And so Isaiah is grieved by this. In several places throughout the book, and you'll find this as you continue reading it there, he says, "Oh, my people, children rule over you to be your princes. Babes shall rule over you. They who lead thee cause thee to err and destroy the way of thy paths." That's why it's so very important that in our voting, we be careful to look beneath the surface. And that's so true in every generation. They who lead thee astray to err in all thy paths. Isaiah was born while grandfather Uzziah was king, and he saw Jotham live and die, and now he's living and writing while this weakling Ahaz is ruling. Everything his grandfather and his father have built up, he's in the act of ruining. Last Sabbath we looked in on the great trial in chapter 1, where God brought all mankind, including you and me in this generation, into his courtroom, the courtroom of the universe, before those two witnesses for the prosecution. The first witness was heaven. The second witness was earth. The heavens represent God's highness and his holiness. And the second one representing God's nearness, his closeness, his interest in the details. In order, he brought us into that courtroom in order that our own consciences would be alerted, activated, so we would begin to reason with God. And that, you remember, was the purpose for it. Come now, let us reason together. And because he's such a God, he pronounces sentence on all of us. "Come now," he says there, just as he pronounces that sentence. "The prisoner, rise, stand to receive your sentence. Come now, saith the Lord. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they're red like crimson, they shall be as wool." I will provide a plan of salvation. I will provide that. And he's in the rest of the book, he's showing us what that plan is. And that vision of that trial impacted Isaiah exactly the same way that I would pray that it impacted every one of us. It's no surprise that Isaiah saw this message from God in terms of his beloved Jerusalem. God will take the things that are close to our own hearts and alert us to spiritual things of eternity because by those means. As a boy, Isaiah had seen Jerusalem at her prosperous best. He was politically alert. He was aware of what was going on around him. He was reared in the court. He would have watched Uzziah and Jotham come and go, and the generals and the judges and representatives of other diplomats from other nations, and growth and development of her defenses her forts and her towers. He would have seen these things taking place. Probably was on almost a first-hand talking relationship, acquaintance with these diplomats. And men were making the decisions for all of Israel. Isaiah had loved it all. He saw the picture of the whole world in the light of his own city. And as Isaiah makes Jerusalem live for us, you can almost see the breathing of the people as he describes it through these chapters. And I've leaped over into chapters 3 and 4 in order to show you something of that a little bit this morning. Watch for it, because you'll be finding it as you read on throughout the whole book. With all of her strengths and her weaknesses, her joys and her sorrows, he shows how the ladies dressed and how they walked with mincing steps. I don't know how you do that, but whatever it was, he had seen that. He had noticed that. And how they talked and how they smelled. I don't know how you get that in there, but he says it right there. And how rumors, confederations, we call them alliances today, affected Jerusalem. And we can see them with the same vividness that we see the wind rippling through the wheat fields in southern Indiana today. He loved that nation and he loved that city. He was a patriot. For 50 years, Isaiah had battled for her best interests. He was a patriot and he was a statesman. But first and even beyond that, he found that he was a prophet. It's not surprising that Isaiah's newly awakened conscience saw this message in terms of his beloved city. The politics of the situation had driven him to become aware of a continuing relationship and a developing relationship between himself and God. And God used that to lead him step by step into his message for us. Not all at once. It would have been too much for that young, tender conscience to have handled. But just as Jesus had said it there, "I've got many things to say unto you, but you cannot bear them yet." So Isaiah has said the same thing here in these chapters. This was the way God, he says, was dealing with me. God leads us and he develops us step by step by step by the political circumstances which we find ourselves, as well as the church circumstances and the family circumstances, and then the personal, individual circumstances. God caused him to see an ideal, and that's the first Jerusalem, the ideal Jerusalem, for those of you who are drawing pictures. With the whole world coming to his beloved Jerusalem, there in those first five verses, let me read some of those for you just a moment. Again, in Isaiah 2, beginning in verse 2, "It shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, Come ye, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." I think we could almost see him as he's standing there at some of the walls, at some, maybe on one of those towers. And he's looking out to the horizon. And he's looking forward to the day when the whole world will be coming there. Oh, so that thing will too. The whole world will be coming to learn from God and to learn about God and what pleases God and what displeases God. The world will be there. She'll be a leader of the whole world. To trade, to learn how to worship that which pleases God and that which does not please God. Not only the things that they made with their fingers, called idols, but anything that would distract and would cause men to prefer what they had written to what God had written as a means of praising Him. As a means of praising Him, to learn to worship. What is it that pleases God? Does God know that better than we do? Yes. Yes, He would know that better than we do. He would know what pleases Him. But we prefer what we've written. And so we very seldom find what he's written, even sung anymore. But here he says that that time would come and to be judged, to learn peace, the kind of peace that lasts forever. The commonwealth of the whole world coming to Jerusalem. And the last verse is a kind of a triumphant shout. O house of Jacob, come ye, and let us walk in the light of the world. We'll lead the whole world. He's the idealist. That's the ideal Jerusalem. That's what he's seeing there. Isaiah saw that ideal Jerusalem. But that's obviously not the end of the chapter or of the book. And so, from gazing out across the horizon, his eyes drop to the city right beneath him there. And as he looks into the wynds and alleys of that city, he becomes a realist. And that's the second Jerusalem. The real Jerusalem. First came the ideal. And second came the real. Her petty politics. Her love of money. Her desecration of the Lord's day and of his worship. Her lewd plays. Isaiah now begins to see for the first time with this awakened conscience. He begins to see the real in terms of the ideal. First, God said it was necessary for him to see the ideal. But now he comes to see the real. Prior to this, he'd seen this all as being, I think, just a gradual development from king to king to king. And that's one of Satan's most subtle methods of work with us. But now he sees the real Jerusalem as it now is, in terms of God's ideal, what God intends her to be, in terms of his absolute standards and his God-breathed word. And the contrast in these verses here, the first six verses, and then the ones that follow that, the contrast is sort of shocking. In the ideal there in verses 1 through 4, Zion is full of the teaching of the Word of God. That's flowing out through her, through to the church witnessing to the whole world, and the world responding to that. In the real, the world is coming in to the church. The Eastern religions are taking over Jerusalem. Treaties are being made. Relationships are being developed. In the ideal, all the nations are coming to worship at Jerusalem. In the real, Jerusalem is going out to begin to worship as they did with their idols. In the ideal, Jerusalem is full of spiritual blessedness. In the real, she's full of spoils. And in the ideal, spears are being beaten into pruning hooks. In the real, there are vast new armies and chariots and horses that are building up more and more. In the ideal, God alone is worshipped. In the real, man and his work stands at the center of everything. And so Isaiah the idealist now becomes Isaiah the realist. The patriot becomes what many would call a cynic. You notice the difference in language there between chapter 2 and verse 2. Lifted up, enthusiastic. And then in 2:11, cast down with depression. Some would call it burnout. Before, Isaiah was building up and promoting. Now, nothing worth preserving and promotion. The Lord himself is destroying her. I think I've seen people go into politics with great ambitions and desires. The ideal is there very clearly. And God blesses that. Without vision, people perish. But then they get close enough to their smoke-filled rooms and what's going on back there, underneath the surface and behind the scenes, the deals that are being worked out. They become cynics. And they die in their cynicism. I believe I've seen people like that. I pleaded with three prominent people in the city of Indianapolis on many different occasions to come back and run for office. They won't do it. They won't do it. And they're going to die without doing it. And they're disillusioned and discouraged today. I don't believe it's possible to get close enough to God's vision for a nation without becoming disappointed and discouraged. And that's where it could have ended. It was at this point that Isaiah's popularity rating fell. His rating in the polls, I'm sure, went way, way down. Because so long as he was prophesying about the ideal Jerusalem, people loved him. But the instant he began to denounce the sins, they squirmed and they squalled. But Isaiah now found that he was more prophet than he was either idealist or realist. And Isaiah's cynicism scorched and boiled and burned as it trickled down onto the heads of their officials, their congressmen, their judges, their administrators. He condemns them outright. In chapter 3, in verses 2 and 3, the mighty man, the man of war, the judge, the prophet, the captain of 50, the honorable man, the cunning artificer, the eloquent orator, are become children. Children playing games, political games. Children to be their rulers and to rule over them. And then as a climax to all this final proof of the case, his description of the womanhood of the real Jerusalem. Beginning there in chapter 3, and that's where I leaked on over into the next chapters. We'll go back for your own reading and for your study next week. It'll be Isaiah 3. But the daughters of Zion, he describes there. You see, the manhood of a state may deteriorate and fall, but the state will come back so long as the womanhood does not fall. But when the womanhood falls, then it's as though that's the last bastion. And she will never come back. I believe we saw that in Russia. As I personally talked with men in the Duma, men in Parliament, one after another, and I learned to sort of get around to this and then ask the question, were you baptized? Well, yeah. Well, how did you get baptized? Because during the years when they were old enough to become baptized, the church was persona non grata. It was shut out. You weren't allowed to be baptized. If they found you had been baptized, then all your scholarships and money to get on into education was cut off. But they said, well, Grandmother brought me in. Grandmother had me baptized. The womanhood, they didn't seem to find a way of killing off all those other babushkas. And so they brought their grandchildren in to be baptized. And the manhood, Isaiah is concerned about that. And so he describes them there, the way they are, and the results of that, the way they became. And Isaiah must have agonized over that because he loved his nation. He loved that beloved Jerusalem. But he came to the place there in chapter 3 and verse 8 where he said, Jerusalem is ruined and Judah is fallen because their tongue and their doings, their word and their works are against the Lord to provoke the eyes of his glory. He struggled with this prophecy, but his conscience had hold of him and would not let him go. And so because he knew that, he gets on to the most difficult stage of all, the third Jerusalem, and that is the prophesying. There are four steps in the development of any prophet of God or of any mature Christian today, for that matter, any patriot, any churchman. First is an awakened conscience. That's what was taking place there in chapter 1. Second, an awareness of the ideal. Third, an awareness of the real, the political facts, the current events, the newspapers around us. And fourth, the courage to proclaim what God will do in order to turn that which is real among us today into that which is His ideal. These are the three Jerusalems, the ideal, the real, and the prophetic. God's plan for changing it now. And the great question was and still is, would God permit any of this to go on living? This is the fuel out of which the cynicism grows. Would he just cut it all off? those cynics and pessimists who live and die in their cynicism. The first two steps they go through, their conscience is awakened. And they see the ideal. But then they fall to that real and die there. Because they don't go on to that next step. They don't go on to that next step. Go on to that next step, Don. Isaiah says, He will cause the buds to come out in the spring. In chapter 4 and verse 2, in that day shall the branch of the Lord be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the earth shall be excellent and comely for them that are escaped of Israel. For them that are escaped. So there will be a judgment. And some of those will be cast out and some of those will die. But there will be a remnant who will escape and go on. And you'll be watching for this in the chapters ahead. A Shi'ar Yashub. A remnant that shall remain. Now let's go on for just a moment or two for applications of this. I wish we had time to talk about how this applies to civil government. And since it was couched in the language of civil government and in the context of civil government, the political science involved is there. I wish we could talk about that for an hour or so, because that does apply to America today. But there isn't time. For the church, the same thing is true. There's the awakened conscience, and then there is the ideal that he wants, and then there's that which we're confronted with throughout the nation around the world today in the church. And then there is the family, and these same three things apply to this. And Rich was talking about that this morning in the family class here. But I think we have to limit ourselves just now to the personal, the individual. So where is it with you in these three Jerusalems in your own life? First, the ideal. When God awakens our conscience, then we can begin seeing that ideal. And of course, that ideal for us is visualized, is actual out there where we can see it in the person of Jesus Christ. Ideal in birth, born of a virgin. Ideal in growth, grew in wisdom and in stature and favor with God and man. Ideal in temptation, tempted in all things like as we are, yet without sin. Ideal in suffering, he suffered all things, being blameless. Ideal in death, he overcame that death. He rose again. And this is what he created us to be. Have you seen that ideal? Have you seen that ideal? What he wants you and me to be. Have you seen that, and how clearly have you seen that? Without vision, people perish. The article's not there in Proverbs. People is not a particular person. It's people perish. Where you don't have vision, this kind of vision, where it's applied to the individual, people will perish. The ideal. But second, have you seen the real in yourself? This is what Tom Sawyer was talking about this morning. The wicked man. But Tom didn't stop with just describing the wicked man. He looked into his own heart and life and invited you to do the same, because that's what the psalm was doing. And then he rightly applied that to that parable of the two men who got up to pray. One of them didn't think anything was wrong with him. He hadn't seen the real person, that which is us, that which we are. And we fall so far, far short of that real in birth, in growth, in temptation, in suffering, in death. We fall so far short of that ideal, the glory of God. And at every point, we fall short. And often, we're tempted just to quit trying and just not look any further. I can remember when I was just coming to be interested in the person of Jesus Christ, when I looked at my own sin and my unholiness, and it seemed to be the more I saw of the holiness and righteousness of Christ, the further away I got. And there was a time there that I've told you about, when I even came to the place of thinking, well, if there's no God, I have no problem. And I began trying to find evidence that would prove that there was no God. But he wouldn't let me alone at that point. And there may be some of you who also have seen the ideal and then looked in at your own heart and life and seen the real and decided you'd just die without trying to see if there's anything to do about that. We can enjoy the ideal, but we dread and fear to look into our own lives, to see ourselves as He sees us and see the real. But God, through Isaiah, said, "See, I have promised you a judgment, so you will go on to respond to my gracious pardon, to be what I created you to do." In John 16, that's why I read that reference there this morning, John 16 and 7 through 11, Jesus described and explained these same three stages. He said, "It's expedient for you, it's the best thing could possibly happen to you, that I go away. For if I go away, I will send the Comforter, the Convictor, who will convict you of sin and of righteousness and of judgment. Of sin, because you don't believe in me. Of righteousness, because I go away and you can't see me anymore. You're going to have to be able to remember my righteousness and see that clearly, the ideal. Your sin and your righteousness. And then remember that I will bring these together in front of me. In my courtroom." A little different order than Isaiah's, but it's the same points. The conviction of sin and need, that's the real. The conviction of righteousness and the ideal. And then the conviction that there will come a time when these have to come together. But it's the same three convictions. God's righteousness, the reality in our own hearts and lives, and the judgment, the prophetic judgment that does bring us together. And God will bring out that remnant who will go on to be His witness to His city, His civil government, His church, His family, and individuals to Him. See His ideal. It's in the person of Jesus Christ. See His real. Don't avoid it. Look into your own heart. See yourself the same way He sees you. Know yourself as He knows you. And then go on to respond to His claims on your life, to be His witness. "Come ye, let us walk in the light of the Lord." Father in heaven, command your blessing upon those who have a vision, just as Isaiah had, for what this nation and all her civil government could be. A nation whose laws would bear out and demonstrate and illustrate the laws of your book. A nation whose judges and the whole judiciary department would be a demonstration of your kind of judgment. A nation whose administrators would be demonstrators of your kind of administration. God bless those who see the ideal and the real and the prophetic in terms of civil government. Bless those who see the ideal, the prophetic, the real and the prophetic in terms of churches. And then God bless those who see it in terms of families. What our family could be, what you want it to be, but what it now is. And what you would bring it to be. And then God bless every individual soul as we would see that ideal. Your reason for creating us, for allowing us to go on living, for building us, your reason for our lives. And then, Lord, bless us as we would have the courage to look into our heart of hearts and see that which is evil and wicked and wrong. But then, God, forbid that any man or woman or boy or girl here should just give up at that point and die in their cynicism. But rather grant that they would hear you saying, "Come now, let us reason together. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Though they be red like crimson, they shall be as wool." God, cause each person here to know that that judgment is not a thing to be feared and to run away from, but a thing for which we can be thankful. Because you are the God you are, with the plan that you've already laid out for making us right in your own eyes. And God bless us then as we would go from there on in her personal lives, her family lives, her church life, and her political life, to become your witness to that which is your ideal, to that which is the real, that we would be alert and sensitive and aware of the sin and evil in our own lives, in the church, in the state, in the family. And then God bless us as we would go on to respond to your claims, to receive your forgiveness, to become your witness as individuals, as a family, as a church, and as a civil government. In Jesus' name we pray it. Amen.